Case number 20-5842, United States of America versus Lavester Grayer. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Deborah Ann Solov for the appellant. You may proceed.
Morning.
Morning, Your Honor. Please the court and AUSA Bedini. My name is Deborah Solov, and I represent appellant defendant Lavester Grayer. I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
It may be tempting to view this as involving just one less gun on city streets, but how this gun was seized and how this defendant was convicted raise an equally serious problem. The public's current distrust of police and skepticism of the fairness of our criminal justice system. There are two primary issues here: denial of a motion to suppress evidence from a warrantless search and denial of a motion for a new trial based on rehafe. And I hope I'm pronouncing that right. As to the first issue, this court should reverse and vacate the conviction. If it reaches the second, the court should reverse and remand for a new trial on the felon in possession count. The government argues a set of facts it failed to prove at the suppression hearing. Facts are stubborn things, and whatever our wishes, our desires, or the inclination of our passion, that cannot alter the state of facts and evidence. John Adams, before the court in defense of the British soldiers in 1770. And facts are indeed the devil is in the details in this case. The Memphis police unit here came off looking like the gang who couldn't shoot straight. Their ineptness started with a lack of records about who was even there on October 3rd, 2016, and continued through the warrantless search and seizure and failure to follow their own tow-in policy. There was a lack of good faith and a total violation of Mr. Grayer's Fourth Amendment rights. Importantly, the Memphis Organized Crime Unit was and had been acting without oversight or transparency.
Counsel, let's talk about the main line of defense here. As I understand it, there were warrants for your client's arrest. They knew that there were warrants. They had his picture, and they seized him when they saw him.
That's
right?
Correct.
Okay. So up to that point, what's wrong? That is, are you saying that if the picture isn't really clear and you seize the right man, then that's wrong? Or what's wrong up to that point?
Well, Lieutenant Cowan said that when they asked about the, you know, what they knew about what he looked like, he said, you know, height and weight. I mean, I
had a picture.
I propose that any black man of middle age, of approximate height of 6 foot, who got out of that Lincoln Town car would be arrested.
But and there were two. Agree they had a picture.
I don't agree they had a picture. No? I agree they say they had a picture. It wasn't in evidence. It was never shown, and no one ever described it. Did he have facial hair?
Did the judge find that person credible?
He did find Lieutenant Cowan's credible, and I argue that his credibility finding is incorrect because there was documentary evidence, okay?
That's the argument, and so you start out, from your point of view, basically, that they had no right to arrest him even though they had arrest warrants. I mean, what's your, do you have any cases that would say, you know, some, I mean, all the cases I've seen is when you arrest the wrong man. You have a picture and you arrest somebody that doesn't look anything like him. Do you have any case that talks about, you know, what's the connection between a picture and arresting the right person?
No, but the evidence that's found, as in Hudson, afterwards should be suppressed, even though the arrest stands.
Okay, but so if the arrest is okay, then they look in the car, again, they say this, and the judge credits it, and see the pistol butt. Arguably, from your side, at that point, they don't know there's any criminality involved.
Correct.
But as I read it, while they're still in the parking lot, they get the information that he is indeed a felon. Now, if you accept that query, is that the main line that you don't accept it? Do you have to know he's a felon the first time you see it, or while you're still, you know, I don't think you're saying they had to leave instantly, you find out that he's a felon. Does that count or not?
I think that Ms. Bedini said that they were in the parking lot, and I don't know who they is.
The testimony, and I had it here, Cowan says, while we were in the parking lot, we called someone from PSN, and they told us that he was a convicted felon.
Right, but it doesn't mean that the defendant was still in the parking lot. He was in the back of a police cruiser and taken downtown, and his interview was done and over with within the hour. So I don't know if that he was still there, and the cases
but
say...
But does that do... Because at this point, we're talking about the seizure of the gun, not his arrest. That is, we just talked about his arrest because of the warrants and the fact that he is the person on the warrant.
Well, how is that immediately incriminating if he's not even still there?
No, I understand that. The gun is incriminating if he's a felon because he was there. He was there in the car. I mean, if you're arguing that he has no responsibility for the gun, even though he was in the car, that's a separate issue. I was talking about the criminality is immediately apparent if he is connected to the gun, if he is in possession.
I'm trying to remember the name of the case in which they were still at during the search, and they found a pen, and they didn't realize it was a weapon. It was a gun, and they seized the pen, even though they didn't know what it was. It was just heavy. And then they talked to an ATF agent who was on the site still during the search, and he said, you know, that could be a weapon. They have guns and et cetera. That was deemed not to be immediate. I mean, you can carry a concealed...
They had already seized... I don't know. If you have the name of the case, I'll be happy to look at it.
It's in my brief, and I'm sorry, I just
okay,
don't remember.
Okay, go ahead.
It might be Semenowski or...
Okay. Go ahead.
But this is more than a search incident to an arrest, right? Because they smelled marijuana?
Well, it wasn't a search incident to arrest because he was out of the car,
right.
Handcuffed.
I mean, they had different justification for the vehicle as opposed to arresting him on the warrants because
Correct. They
smelled marijuana, right?
It's my contention that they... were so inconsistent that the plain smell was not enough to get into the car alone, and that they said it was burnt marijuana, both people who testified, and it was raw, and what they found was raw. There was no finding that there was any paraphernalia or burnt marijuana in the car, and the judge even said, recognizing the inconsistency, well, they would have smelled it once they got in the car for the gun. So he wasn't relying on plain smell to get in the car. He was relying on plain smell to search the containers within the car. And the gun, he said, the judge said, and I believe he's both goes to credibility issues and it goes to the clear errors in his facts. He said there were four officers who saw this gun outside, standing outside the car, after he was arrested. And there was only one who testified, Lieutenant Cowens, who said he saw it. He didn't say where he was standing or when he saw it. He was the supervisor. He was the last one on the site. He said it was between the armrest and the console. And I beg you to look at the color photo that is really important because this is documentary evidence that does not go along with Lieutenant Cowan's testimony. He couldn't even recognize where the gun was in this photo. It's on the floor of the car. And the judge later says, Lieutenant Cowan's, I believe, saw the gun on the floorboard of the car. He never said that. He couldn't even recognize this picture. I think it's Exhibit 2. So Judge Boggs, I'll go back to your question. I disagree with some of the basis of it. These detectives purposely never used body cams or dash cams, never recorded interviews, didn't require handwritten statements, failed to prepare separate arrest reports and complaints, which had been criticized in Monroe, It failed to make a written record of each officer involved, so you couldn't even subpoena the officers or interview them to see what they saw. It failed to produce records of their communications, including the photo on their PDAs. It didn't have surveillance logs, and it had no record of the tip that caused them to find Grayer's arrest warrant or go to the grocery store. The court was yes.
A credibility determination.
Pardon me?
Isn't that really a credibility determination? You have all of this odd record keeping and strange recall that the district judge is in the best position to determine whether this is really just a big cover up.
It is, Your Honor. It is, but the court doesn't have unlimited discretion in making that credibility determination. If documents or objective evidence contradict the witness's story, or if the story itself is so internally inconsistent or implausible that a reasonable fact finder wouldn't credit it. So my argument is that the judge made, well, first of all, the judge made mistakes in his findings of fact, in part because the prosecutor led him down that pathway with an incorrect representation before the hearing started. The judge noted that repeatedly and pointedly during the hearing, that the prosecutor hadn't proven what he said he was going to prove. But then when the post-hearing memo came out, the prosecutor alleged the same facts that the judge had just pointed out he hadn't proven. But then 2 months later, when the judge issued his oral decision, and that was after there was a transcript, he pretty much went along with those facts. And so I think there was there were credibility issues with these witnesses. Cowan was found to be credible, even though he couldn't identify that picture of where the gun was. And Gooch, who wrote in his report that Myers saw the butt of a pistol between the seat and the center console, it never says where Myers was or when he saw it, and it's hearsay. And that's also not what the photo showed. Detective Gooch couldn't identify the pistol in the photo either. The judge finally just told them what he saw. Your Honor, I see my time is up, and I haven't gotten to even the Rahafe issue. But if you have any questions on Rahafe.
Well, not with your time being up, unless you want to take some time for your rebuttal. But I think that's it for right now.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Morning.
My name is Naya Bedine. I represent the United States. This court should affirm Mr. Grayer's conviction. There are two issues on this appeal. First, the district court properly denied Mr. Grayer's motion to suppress. And second, there were no plain Rahafe errors in this case. As to the suppression issue, the district court properly denied the motion to suppress because both Mr. Grayer's arrest and the search of his car were legal. Mr. Grayer was arrested because he had two outstanding arrest warrants. It started when the officers received a tip as to Mr. Grayer's location. The tip informed the officers that Mr. Grayer would be at the corner grocery in a red Lincoln Town Car, and it described what Mr. Grayer looked like. The tip also informed the officers that Mr. Grayer often dealt drugs from that location. Then the officers performed their own investigation. They looked in their databases and they pulled and they found that Mr. Grayer indeed had two outstanding arrest warrants. One was for aggravated assault, domestic assault, and another one was a juvenile court warrant. And then the officers did more. They found his picture. They pulled Mr. Grayer's picture and they distributed it among each other. They had his picture when they did surveillance at the corner grocery. They went to the corner grocery, they sat in the parking lot as they testified, and they waited for Mr. Grayer.
Did the officers already have an arrest warrant for him when they went to the corner grocery?
They did, Your Honor. They were aware that Mr. Grayer had two outstanding arrest warrants, and one of them was the juvenile court. The other one was aggravated assault slash domestic assault. They had all this information. They conducted surveillance. They saw Mr. Grayer come out of the car and walk into the corner grocery. And then two of the officers who testified said that they positively identified him. And they had radios, and they were talking to each other, and they informed each other that, yes, that's Mr. Grayer. Unlike all the cases and all the scenarios that the defense raises here, the officers here identified him first and seized second. After Mr. Grayer was arrested, the officers then searched the car, and as we've argued, the search of the car is supported on multiple bases. As an initial matter, both officers who testified said that they smelled marijuana when they approached the car. First, the officers testified that they arrested Mr. Grayer right outside his car. The car door was open, and then they smelled marijuana. It's significant also that Mr. Grayer himself stated while he was on the witness stand that Officer Gooch mentioned out loud the smell of marijuana coming from the car. And in fact, as this court knows, marijuana was indeed found in the car.
With respect to that testimony, did he distinguish between the raw marijuana and the burnt marijuana?
They did, Your Honor. The officers testified.
No, you were quoting Grayer as saying the officer told him.
Correct.
He did not distinguish.
He just said Officer Gooch mentioned that we smelled
then
marijuana.
As did the other part, what, there were two different officers, one said burnt, one said raw?
At the testimony, both officers said that they smelled burnt marijuana. The inconsistency is that, of course, raw marijuana was found, and also the arrest ticket stated that the officers smelled raw marijuana.
But no burnt marijuana.
No burnt. There's
found, although I suppose the smell could be there without the marijuana,
right,
but might not.
There's nothing in the record to explain the burned smell of marijuana, but, you know, it could have been anything. It could have been that the defendant, you know, was smoking before he got in the car. I'm not sure why they smelled burned marijuana, but, you know, the testimony as to whether it was burned or raw is not so inconsistent that to make the officer's testimony not credible, and the district judge did find him credible. And then the second, you know, part is that the officers testified that they saw a gun in plain view. As the district court found, it was unrefuted where the gun was. They consistently testified that it was between the armrest and the center console. The picture shows that. You know, the testimony was the butt.
Sorry, why do you say the picture shows that? Your adversary says the picture shows it on the floorboard.
They never stated that it was not on the floorboard. It is on the floorboard, and it is in, and they're both true, Your Honor. It is on the floorboard, and it is between the console.
Is that because the picture was taken later after they moved the?
They did not move the gun. They took the picture before they moved the gun, but the picture shows the butt of the gun sticking, and it's located between the seat and the center console area, sitting on the floor.
Okay. So it's on the floor between the seat
I
and
see.
The console.
Okay.
That's one way to read it, Your
and
Honor.
And is that something you would see just by?
Yes, Your Honor, if you're looking, if the part of the gun is sticking out, the officers testified that they did see it. And both officers said they saw it. It's in the arrest warrant. The arrest ticket that Officer Myers saw it. Then the testimony, of course, is that shortly after they saw it, pulled and found out that he was indeed a convicted felon. As Your Honor pointed out earlier, the officer Cohen stated that they were still in the parking lot when they found out that he was a convicted felon.
Who was still in the parking lot?
The officers and Mr. Grayer sitting in the police car.
What were they doing? Processing him? Or?
They had arrested him at that point, Your Honor, and they saw the gun simultaneously. They smelled the marijuana. Then they searched the car. At that time, he was in the back of the police car. So each of these bases on its own provided the officers with probable cause to search the car. Of course, you know, there's more. The standard is totality of the circumstances. We've also argued that, you know, of course, the officers just arrested him on an aggravated assault charge, and they also had a tip that he was dealing drugs from that location. Those additional facts add to a finding that there was probable cause based on the totality of the circumstances.
Well, was the tip enough, or, I mean, was it the smell?
It was the smell, Your Honor. That was the main thing. That's the government's argument, is that the smell was the this most significant factor in this case. The tip, of course, let the officers know that he might be potentially selling drugs from that location, and having smelled the marijuana, you know, they corroborated part of that tip. Based on all these facts that I've just stated, the officers had probable cause to search the car and arrest Mr. Grayer and then search his car. So the court should affirm as to the suppression issue. As to the rehaif issue, it is true in this case that the indictment did not include the knowledge of status element as required by rehaif, but Mr. Grayer cannot show that the error in the indictment affected his substantial rights or the integrity and fairness of the proceeding.
No, I believe you keep saying there was probable cause to search the car. Does that mean you would concede that they could not search the car without probable cause? The officer said that they were searching incident to the arrest. But even if, putting that aside, could the officers have performed an inventory search following his arrest? Why would not an inventory search of the vehicle have been legal even in the absence of probable cause?
Certainly, Your Honor, that's one of the bases that the district court found. Even had there been no probable cause to search the car, the district court found that the government had proved by a preponderance of the evidence that an inventory search would have occurred. And pursuant to MPD policy, a Memphis Police Department policy, one could conduct an inventory search after a lawful arrest if the car, if nobody else can drive the car, and if it's parked illegally. And the district court in this case did find that there was nobody else to move the car, and also found that most likely it was located in front of a store, and most likely the owner of the store would not have given him permission. That's certainly another basis to find that the evidence in this case, the drugs and the gun, would have been inevitably found pursuant to proper police department policy. Going back to the rehaif question, the defendant's substantial rights were not affected in this case because there was no reasonable probability that the rehaif error would have changed the outcome of the proceedings in this case, and that's for two reasons. The evidence shows that Mr. Grayer knew he was a convicted felon, and the second reason is the government actually did prove at trial that he was a convicted felon. As to the first reason, you know, the evidence as a whole showed that he was a convicted felon because he had 16 prior offenses, convictions, and he had indeed served in excess of 1 year for many of those convictions. He'd served 8.5 years for robbery charges and 4 years on drug charges. And Mr. Grayer, in this case, entered a stipulation that he was indeed a convicted felon. And, you know, as the Supreme Court stated in the recent case, United States v. Greer, post-rehaif case, a felon faces an uphill climb to satisfy the plain error review based on an argument that he didn't know he was a felon. And the reason for that is simple. If a person knows he's a felon, if a person is a felon, he ordinarily knows he's a felon. And the second reason is the government actually did prove at trial that Mr. Grayer was a convicted felon and that he knew he was a convicted felon. Mr. Grayer was asked on cross-examination at trial whether he knew as of October 3rd, 2016, that he was a convicted felon, and he said yes. And of course, we also have a statement of Mr. Grayer that was introduced at the suppression hearing. And Mr. Grayer, in that statement, which was given the day he was arrested, October 3rd, 2016, he acknowledges that he has a number of priors, robbery charges, drug charges, which also shows that he knew as of that day that he was a convicted felon. Lastly, the jury was instructed in this case, was properly instructed as to the knowledge of status element. The judge explained it to the jury and also added it as an element in the jury instructions. So for these reasons, there was no reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different but for the Rehaif error in the indictment. And I want to finish by pointing out that the Supreme Court did say in Greer that there's a chance that the defendant might make an adequate showing on appeal that he did not in fact know. And in here, the defendant has not argued that he didn't know either below or on appeal. And of course, I mean, that's, he faced an uphill climb to argue that because he has given statements and testified that he did know he was a convicted felon. For these reasons, and the court should affirm Mr. Grayer's conviction.
All right, thank you. I'll take rebuttal at this time.
Yes, I'll start with Rehaif. Well, first of all, the old chief stipulation, of course, does not say you know that you were a felon. You know, I was a prosecutor. We did them to save them from having those robbery convictions put in front of the jury or whatever. And the court in Greer, which came out after I finished my reply brief, said that that alone's not enough, but she's right. It is an uphill climb at that point. It says, you know, you need to submit something, circumstantial evidence or a representation that you did not know. And I did that, not knowing of the requirement, but knowing that it was important. The specific rebuttal of knowledge of prior convictions was that he was sentenced on 11 state crimes in a single consolidated sentencing hearing over 20 years ago, committed when he was 19 years old. This is in the PSI. He was similarly sentenced in a single hearing on a simple assault and four separate drug sales when he was 30 years old. He served a total of 5 years on the 11 crimes sentenced at the same time, which works out to half a year for each one, if you divide it, and less than a year on the four drug sales, also sentenced at the same time. I will note, and I didn't argue it, but it is in the record, that the court sent Mr. Grayer for a mental competency exam. I'm not sure what prompted it. General rebuttal would have included, until now he was never charged nor convicted of any federal crime nor any state or federal felon in possession charge. And that's totally different than most of the cases that came before the Sixth Circuit on Rehaif, and certainly different than the ones that say that you would have known. Unlike the defendant in the cases the trial referenced, he was not on probation or parole at the time of his possession, which also would, you know, say you can't have a gun. And he didn't evidence a guilty mind by running, resisting arrest, or denying the gun possession. Counting up state felony cases is not particularly helpful. Sentence length is the issue. It's a year or more, a potential sentence of a year or more. And many state felonies have potential sentences of a year or less. Despite many pro se pleadings by Mr. Grayer, there's never one where he concedes knowledge. And the question he was asked at trial was not exactly, did you know at the time you had the gun on October 6, 2016, that you had a felony conviction? That would have ended this. But that's not what was asked. The question was ambiguous. Did you know that you were a felon? Knew, he did know. His attorney had told him he was. We were going to stipulate it in old chief, obviously. So, and the date in that sentence could modify, did you know as October 3rd, or did you, were you a felon as of October 3rd? Yes, he was a felon on October 3rd. That's what the old chief says.
Time has expired. You may want to wrap up there.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Case is submitted.